session number 29724, reel 4.
Okay, so that's reel 4. Did you do any sort of basic aerobatics while you were doing your elementary flying training?
Oh, in the Tiger Moth, yes, and pretty well throughout your training, if you were training on aerobatic, on aeroplanes which could do aerobatics, yes, most certainly. And you were taught aerobatics in the Tiger Moth, and you'd be sent up to practice them once you'd prove to your instructor that you could do them.
What type of manoeuvres were you doing?
You do loops and rolls, mainly slow rolls, loops, stall turns, standard aerobatics, really. And you either loved them or you hated them. And, of course, I think it's that stage that fighter pilots would be selected. An instructor would begin to pick up the temperament, and at the end of the course, in most training courses, there will be a recommendation recommended for fighters or torpedo bombers or whatever, and that was based really on the sort of temperament of a fighter pilot. I mean, you, probably in your 40 interviews you will come across chaps who are quite, even at my age, who quite clearly would make excellent fighter pilots, and others who were far better in sedate aircraft. Yes, we did practice aerobatics.
How did you loop the Tiger Moth? Was it an easy aircraft to loop? Or
quite easy to do. You just stuck it on its nose, got the correct airspeed, hauled back on the control column, and it would go around on its own accord. The only thing you had to concentrate on, make sure your wings were level. When you're upside down, you still have a horizon, so that's no problem, really.
What about stall turns? How do you conduct them?
Stall turn, again, you put the aircraft on its tail by moving the control column fully back, and then give a hard left or right rudder, and the nose then falls down with no speed on the aircraft, and then ends up in a dive from which you recover. So it's quite easy.
And slow rolls?
Now that requires a lot of skill, because in a Tiger Moth you have no reserve of power, and there's a tendency for the engine to cut out when it's inverted. So that, again, you needed to get the speed right, and the roll itself completed fairly quickly, otherwise you just fell out of it. But an aeroplane with a fuel injection where the engine continues to run, of course, makes the whole thing far simpler. But you had to work hard in those primitive aeroplanes that we started with.
And could you explain to me what a barrel roll is?
Yes, barrel rolling was the difference between a barrel rolling and an ordinary slow roll. Was a barrel roll, you were flying a roll. But you were never actually hanging and experiencing gravity. It was just a flown circle like that. I mean, you were upside down, but you were flying under power, whereas a slow roll, there are certain periods when you are completely experiencing gravity and having to allow for it. Very much more skill, the slow roll. Barrel roll is a very simple and very safe manoeuvre. And it's been done by commercial airliners in their time. So. But I don't think commercial airliners would attempt a slow roll where everything is utterly upside down and literally everything falls down.
And what was the appearance of the Tiger Moth? I'm thinking, what colour was it? Was it camouflage? Was it?
Yes, they were generally green and green fuselage, I think, with yellow wings. Certainly a fair amount of yellow. All training aircraft, I think, in this country, even now, I may be wrong, have yellow somewhere, because yellow shows up extremely well. And, of course, one thing you would need to avoid mid-air collisions and so on. And the man who discovered that was a chap called Fokker. in World War One, who built Richthofen's Fokker triplanes and all the rest of it, and he was the first man to say that the colour orange or yellow stands out more than any other colour from the air. Because it also applies to cars. I don't know if you've ever noticed, if you ever see a yellow painted car, and not many of them, and I personally couldn't have seen painting one, but you see them a mile away. Safest colour you could ever have. And so training aircraft, my day, and I think still possibly, a lot of yellow paint.
So what was the next stage after you'd finished at Elmsdon? Where was the...
Yes, after Elmsdon, I was sent to Peterborough, which is another Royal Air Force flying training school, forget the number, and we then converted to Hawker Harts and Audaxes. That was again a pre-war two-seater with a Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine, a lot bigger than the Tiger Moth. Again, even more difficult to land, oddly enough, than the Tiger Moth. I had a bit of difficulty, and I took a little longer to convert to the Hawker Hart than I did with my initial training on Tiger Moths, but I mastered it in the end. But it was a very much heavier biplane, but the general characteristics were virtually much the same as the Tiger Moth, just everything was very much bigger and noisier and so on, and faster.
Does that affect you, just those factors, that the aircraft is faster, or is that something that really you could take in yourself?
No, I didn't really notice it. I was involved in training in the USA later on, and you had pilots going from a 450-horsepower Harvard onto a Corsair with 3,000 horsepower, and they mastered it quite easily. Again, if I like a bicycle, once you learn to ride a bicycle, you can always ride a bicycle. And I think to some extent that applies with aeroplanes. And so the power and so on is there, and you notice it in terms of acceleration on takeoff and that sort of thing. And approach speeds are higher. But once you're in the air, the sensation of speed, of course, is lost because you've got nothing, unless you're going past a cloud or a building, you don't get the sensation of speed. I mean, you can be doing 400 miles an hour next to another aeroplane and not be aware of it.
Obviously, at this stage, you would have done some low flying as well. What's the sensation of low flying like then?
Great fun and highly illegal. Yes, I can't. I'm sure there isn't a pilot in the world who hasn't at some stage flown high. And the reason for that, of course, is that is where you get the sensation of speed. But if you're whizzing over the ground at 200 miles an hour, things are going past at the rate of knots and approaching. And so, of course, that's where the excitement comes. And that's why it's done so illegally. But over the last 50 years, of course, the regulations for low flying are now restricted to certain areas. And you go up to Wales, where one of my daughters is located. She's on a low flying track from RAF Valley. And it's a bit noisy. But they're allowed to do it legally. But if I want to come down here and beat up a friend in the house across the way, a bright policeman might just get my number and it would be reported to the nearest airfield and I'd be in serious trouble. But every pilot at some stage will have done low flying, either illegally or legally. Legally, of course, part of the training, illegally for the fun of it.
With this second period of training, how was that organised? Would you still be with an instructor, or did you spend much more of your time on your own?
No, much the same. Followed the same sort of pattern, really. Flight commander's checks, occasional change of instructor. If your instructor was on holiday, you'd have another instructor. The ratio between solo and dual flying would probably be as it was for the Tiger Moth, very little difference.
Have they introduced any other elements into the training?
Not really, no. You do longer navigation exercises. You'd practice flying at altitude and using oxygen, which you wouldn't do in a Tiger Moth. That's about the only difference that I can think of. Oh, and it would, of course, take on night flying. That was a big element in the second stage. And again, that could produce a small washout rate of people who couldn't cope at night. And that really, night flying under wartime conditions was really quite difficult, because we just had what were called gooseneck flares, paraffin flares on each side of a runway if you had one, or on an airfield if you had grass airfield, and a glide path or two glide path indicators at the beginning of the runway. You'd have a box with three lights with a green light, amber light or a red light. And if you've got your approach speed correct and your rate of ascent correct, you would see a green light. And then you would have to concentrate on the landing, which would be more or less in the darkness. And that could be really quite difficult, particularly in those aircraft that we were flying. For some extraordinary reason, the aircraft had built-in floodlights, but we weren't allowed to use them, and I never understood why. And there were also runway floodlights, which could be put on, and they weren't put on. We were, some reason or other, taught under the most difficult conditions, which was probably quite a good idea.
Had you done any preparation prior to actually doing a night flight? I'm thinking of maybe using a hood or something.
No, we did a hood for instrument flying practice, and I should have mentioned that with the Tiger Moth, we had a hood on the Tigers and did a certain amount of instrument flying practice, which was really largely a waste of time because the instruments were so primitive. But we did do it, yes.
Is it difficult in the first stages to actually trust your instruments rather than your own
sensations? It is difficult, yes, because the it's very easy to lose a sense of balance if you haven't got an outside reference. And you can feel through the balance systems in between your ears sensations which give you the impression that you're doing something which you're not actually doing. And you need an instrument to tell you what you are doing. And in the Tiger Moth, it was a turn and bank, which was literally two needles and very primitive. And not very easy, but with the current artificial horizons, you have a little airplane in front of you on a circular dial, and that shows you completely if your wings are up or down, and you can correct it without a bother. And you have to ignore what your body is telling you and actually trust the instruments.
With the night flying, what type of flying would you do? Would it be a circuit of the airfield?
Training, entirely circuits. We didn't do any cross-country night flying, because by then it was wartime conditions, and so everything was blacked out. You had no references. You could pick up a town even in wartime, but all street lamps had gone, road lights of all sorts, car lights were dimmed, it was all pretty black. And so that night flying, was, because of the landing, which was the most difficult phase, was concentrated entirely in the airfield, almost entirely.
It seems like it must have been very hard to judge on the landing.
Very difficult, extremely difficult, and it could be done because we did it, but quite a lot, some pilots had some difficulty. In fact, there were cases, not on my RAF airfield, but where a chap kept on attempting to land and never made it until he ran out of fuel. Crash, poor chap. Got away with it, I think. But simply couldn't master it. Even though, presumably, he had managed to do it with his instructor. But again, you had instructors who... Perhaps one shouldn't say this. There was an occasional instructor who would take a chance with a pupil, and the two of them would probably do the landing when they were doing instructing, and he might then get out and say, oh, well, he'll get away with it, and probably didn't. You know, it's very difficult. There were other situations. You could start the night flying at dusk. This was thought to be a good idea, because as it got darker, so it became more difficult and more providing the sort of conditions you really wanted. And there were rather unfair accusations made that instructors got out while it was still dusk, leaving the pupils to do the difficult stuff. How much of that was true, I wouldn't like to say. But yes, night flying in those aircraft under wartime conditions, I think my colleagues would say, was really quite difficult.
Did you do any formation flying at that?
Yes, formation flying. Not in Tiger Moths, other than if the instructors wanted to play. But no, we didn't. I don't remember doing any formation flying in a Tiger Moth, but we certainly did once we got to the next stage, because we were flying really military aircraft which were just going out of service and being replaced by more up-to-date aircraft.
How did that get organised? What type of formations would you...
You'd have a very careful briefing on the ground. If there were three aircraft going up, all three pilots, all three students would all be present. The manoeuvres that they were going to carry out would be agreed beforehand. If you had radio, there was no problem. But without radio, you had to use hand signals to move aircraft around. And that required enormous care. There are quite a lot of collisions that could take place with a formation flying. And a careful briefing beforehand and careful flying on the part of everybody was absolutely vital.
What configuration would you be in when you were in formation flying?
The instructor would be in the leading aircraft, and probably initially instructors and pupils in the two aircraft, one each side. Ultimately, the instructor in the leading aircraft and a pupil on each side. And you had to practice changing position and that sort of thing, or flying line astern. And these movements had to be carefully done. Very, very occasionally you get some idiot who'd chop the tail off as it came across. Those sort of accidents, but very rare.
How close would you roughly be flying if you were flying in formation?
Normal speeds. Quite normal cruising speeds.
And how close?
Well, oddly enough, it could be very close. When I got to naval training, where we had naval instructors, they insisted on very close formation flying, and we could get our wings tucked into each other like in that way. And touch in the air without getting away with it. But I think that was just naval bravado rather than sensible flying. But certainly I flew much closer formations in the Navy and I ever did with the RAF, for some reason or other. I don't know why. We had a lot of wild naval instructors, and I suppose they were getting bored.
What's the technique for formating on another aircraft? Is there a way that you get close to it?
Yes, very gentle operation of the throttle. You know, no good roaring up at high speed and putting a brake on. It wouldn't work that way. You'd overshoot. So it just required very gentle flying of the controls and very gentle throttle handling. The interesting thing about formation flying, which I'm sure you know about, is that if you've got an aircraft, two aircraft with one leading, the two aircraft will be flying at a lower power setting because they get lift from the airflow from the leading aircraft. And that's why birds do the same. The birds fly in formation and the leading bird has all the effort. And it's assumed that the leading bird comes back and another one takes over. But all the other birds are getting some lift from the bird in front of them. Less physical exertion. Fascinating.
And what about the course? Was there a washout rate in this second stage? With there was a small amount for night flying.
Usually to do with night flying. Occasionally landing problems. The Hart was a Hart and Audax. All that range of aircraft really were quite tricky to land. And it would have been a very modest washout. Probably about 2 or 3%, something like that.
Was there any accidents with the Hawk and the Audax?
Largely taxiing accidents, because they were taxiing bigger aircraft. Occasional formation flying accidents. I can't remember any engine failures leading to accidents on forced landing. No, we had a remarkably accident-free record in training.
What about visibility in the Hart and the Audax?
Not terribly good. No, again, a biplane, and the wings were more staggered than they were in the Tiger Moth, so that also removed part of your visibility. Yes, not terribly good.
And did it have a longer nose as well?
A longer nose, that's right, yes. Yes. But I think one had automatically adjusted to the aircraft that you were in, as one did with a Swordfish, where you had a radial engine, which again knocked out a lot of forward view, which was pretty vital for deck landing, of course.
Had you received ground instruction during this training period? I'm thinking in subjects like meteorology or extra navigation.
Yes,
and stuff
there
like
were.
That.
We had ground school. A lot of it, as you say, meteorology would be one of them. The construction of aircraft, the maintenance and mechanics of engines. That sort of thing, yes. We flew in the morning, ground school in the afternoon, and vice versa.
And what degree were you supposed to understand these subjects? I mean, I'm thinking, say, you mentioned aircraft construction and engines.
Ground instruction, you had an exam at the end of the course, which I don't know whether anybody failed. And flight commander's checks throughout the flying training, so much the same as the Tiger Moth, really.
Did the Hart and Audax have any kind of vices? Because you said that the Tiger Moth seemed to be quite viceless, really, in its thing.
Yes, the Hart was pretty viceless as well. It just became very tricky. It had a very firm undercarriage. There was no resilience in it. A good aeroplane undercarriage will absorb the weight and lower the aircraft. If you didn't get it absolutely right in the Hart, the thing would continue to bounce like a rubber ball, and you'd have to go around and have another try. It was really quite difficult. I think pilots who learnt on that sort of aeroplane will always remember what they require. I mean, even the instructors occasionally make a nonsense of it.